Welcome to Season 2 of Forged in Fire, where we explore LGBTQ+ leadership with guests from all over the world. You'll hear as they share how they navigated their journey through crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Bree Fram, an astronautical engineer in the U.S. Space Force. I'm passionate about building the leaders of tomorrow and learning about what the LGBTQ+ leaders of today can teach us.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to our very first live episode of Forged in Fire. This episode was recorded at the Keystone Conference, a celebration of gender diversity hosted by Trans Central PA. Our guest today is Joanne Carroll, the Executive Director of Trans Advocacy Pennsylvania, a commissioner on the Pennsylvania Commission on LGBTQ Affairs, a past president of Trans Central PA, and a past president of Equality PA, and a life member of the Disabled American Veterans. Joanne serves as a consultant to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and is a member of the Governor's LGBT Working Group, the Millersville University President's Commission on Gender and Sexual Diversity, and is a member of the Transgender American Veterans Association and co-chair of the Keystone Conference. Her advocacy and activism has been noteworthy. In 2022 and 2023, she was honored as one of the 100 most influential LGBTQ leaders in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Recently, the YWCA of Harrisburg named her as a Woman of Excellence for 2023. She is an active member of the Penn Central Conference, United Church of Christ, Open and Affirming Ministry Team, and serves Christ Church United Church of Christ in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, as president of the consistory. Joanne, it's wonderful to have you on our show today. Joanne, I got to hear one of your presentations earlier in the conference, and you shared a story about starfish that I think would be fantastic to kick us off. Would you tell our audience a little bit about starfish and why that's important at a trans conference?
Well, I heard this story, a number of years ago, and I went, holy crap, that really defines what I'm trying to do. And there's a story about a little boy who's on the beach. Some of you may have heard it. He picks up a starfish and he slings it out into the water. And this old man said, honey, what are you doing? He says, I'm saving starfish. He said, really? Look up and down the beach. There's hundreds. Can you think you can save them all? He said, I don't have to. I can at least save one. So my modus operandi for I don't know how long has been if I could change one mind or help one person change how they're doing, I've lived into what I should be doing. But at the conference, I was talking to an individual who's working very actively in the trans community, and she said, you know what we need to do? We need to find more about why those starfish are on the beach. And that's where I think we are. It's one thing to save each other from what we got to deal with. It's one better to go ahead and find out why we're all having trouble. And so that's my starfish story is now an expanded one.
Thank you for sharing that story. Speaking of knowing why, we'd like to go back to earlier in your life. You didn't come out till later, but you knew from an early age that you were one of the little girls. Would you tell us a bit about that?
I'll fess up in public here. I was born in 1940, so if you do math, you know I'm 83 years old. But at about 4 or 5 was when I figured out there was something going on because my little girl cousins at Christmas were getting dolls and tea sets, and I was getting cannons and tractors. They were wearing Mary Janes and pinafores, and I was wearing brogans and bow ties, and there was something wrong with that picture. There was two other little girls in my neighborhood growing up, Reva and Carolyn, and we were the three best friends in the world. We were everywhere together. Now, there were smelly little urchins down the street they called boys. The three of us were either with them or none of us were with them. It was just one of those things. We were tight. We would do dolls and tea sets. We did all the things any other three little girls would do. The only thing was different, they addressed me differently. And so, yeah, I kind of figured that out. But how do you have language in the 1940s for how to describe what you're feeling? it just wasn't there. Besides, I grew up in an incredibly Baptist home. I'm a Reformed Baptist, by the way. A very Reformed one. But how do you tell parents that are quite religious? My daddy was a missionary for the Assembly of God Church right at one point. But how do you tell somebody about that? You don't. And nobody really had language until Christine Jorgensen came back in 1952 from Denmark after having her gender assignment surgery. So language is a problem. So I wasn't being able to, I couldn't quantify it when I was dealing with it. But obviously, as time went along and finally Al Gore invented the internet, then I was okay because there was something I could do to find out. So.
And you did come out to your mom, and you have a story about that as well?
Yeah, she was priceless. I came out to her when I was about, I transitioned in 2001 at the age of 60. So this has been the best 23 years of my life, I would honestly tell you that. But I came out to my mother, and she said, "Honey, why didn't you tell me before?" And I said, "Well, Mom, you don't understand. There's just a lot of guilt that comes with this." She said, "Honey, why would you feel guilty about something you're obviously born with?" And I was crushed. I couldn't believe that she was that accepting. She never got my pronouns wrong, never misgendered me. It was perfect. But the story I think that you're referring to was I would drop her off at a little conservative church on Sunday mornings, and I'd go to my office in the hotel I was working at. And I'd do catch up on all my administrative work while she went to church and Sunday school, and then I'd go pick her up. But I went one time as my boy self, and I met this friend of hers that she had made. Well, a couple of months after I transitioned, we were in the grocery store, and we met this woman. And she didn't pay much attention to me, but hearing my mom, beep, 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 back and forth. And finally the woman says, "Who's this?" And my mom says, "Well, that's my daughter, Joanne." She said, "Oh my goodness, I knew you had a son. I didn't know you had a daughter." Mom said, "Well, that's the same person, but I like her better." So that was my mom. That was how great she was. She was bedridden for the last 15 months of her life. I was her full-time caregiver. About 3 months before she died, she said, "Honey, I'm so glad you're a girl." And I went, "Okay." She said, "If you were a boy giving me this level of care, people might think it was creepy." But she had a sense of humor, and God bless her, she was wonderful. Died at 102.
Joanne, you had a long period in your life where you had to blend in with the crowd. You really acted, and perhaps sometimes overacted, as the chameleon who fit in perfectly with her surroundings. What did that do to you to become the leader that you are today?
Well, I'm not sure those experiences necessarily led me to that, but I will tell you that having 20 years in the Air Force and working 20 years in the hospitality industry, including managing hotels, probably is what got me to where I am today. I did hide. You know, when I was born in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and we immigrated to the United States when I was 7. They didn't let me vote. But anyhow, when you're seeing oot and a boot, and you're a bit chubby, and you're not athletic at all, closest thing I come to athletics is dribbling out of the corner of my mouth when it's basketball time. But in any case, I was picked on until I was like 13. Mom was my safety valve. She really was. She was my hero forever. Anyhow, when I got to be about 13, I said, "I got to learn how to be a good actor." So I joined a group of hoods, back as that was a term we used for all the greasers back in those days. The kids out of the Grease movie, long jeans and And from that point on, it was a matter of acting out the rest of my life. I joined the Air Force when I was 20 with the idea that I was going to go to college because there were no good jobs at that point because there had been veterans that came back from Korea and they were sucking them all up. So I joined the Air Force. I joined the Air Force because I didn't want to get dirty or wet. But what happened is later on in life, I was an air commando in special ops and I did have to get dirty or wet anyways. That didn't matter. But one of the places I hid was that one time I owned a bull riding rodeo company. So I did everything I could to say that look at this person. They're a masculine male. And God forbid anybody could have seen inside because that little girl was screaming at me every day, every night, wanting out. And I'd go to bed at night praying, say, "God, either take this away or fix it. One or the other. I'll take whatever you can throw at me, but either one of those two and I'd take it." So, yeah.
How did fate play a role for you with these experiences early in life of struggling with identity before eventually coming out?
Well, that journey really didn't start until late in adulthood, really. Granted, I grew up in the Baptist church As I told you, Daddy was a missionary. And of course, that stilted his view in terms of his biblical worldview. To use Christian parlance, if everybody will forgive, I was saved at 11, saved at 10, baptized at 11, and he molested me at 13. Now, so suffice it to say, I got mad at God. First of all, I'm burdened with this stuff on the inside and with what his actions of his being such a hypocrite. I yelled at God for almost the rest of my life. Until I had gone, later in life, I had gone on a job search. This is after I retired from military. I was looking for another hotel job, and I was living in Central Texas and was driving up to Denver, Colorado to see what I could gin up. And I was on my way back. And some of you, if you've ever been out in Western Texas, you know maybe what I'm talking about. There's a highway that starts way up in Montana and goes all the way down to the Gulf called Highway 287. Well, that highway goes straight through Amarillo, Texas, okay? Well, somewhere just south of Amarillo, there was a rest stop. And I pulled in that rest stop and was dumbfounded because I had just stopped like 15 miles before Amarillo and gone to the bathroom, bought a soda, let my dog out for a walk. And here I am in this rest stop, and I'm looking around saying, what in the heck am I doing here? And all of a sudden, something struck me, and I started to pray. I said, God, I am so sorry that I've yelled at you for so long. You're not my problem. I am. I'm in my way. You're not. So please forgive me, and if there's room back in a family of faith, please let me come back. And that was my journey back to faith. Now, there's a second part to that story that I haven't told a lot of people. About 4 years ago, well, I live in Lancaster, just south of here. And there's a church there called Community Mennonite, and it's an open and affirming church, and they asked me to come in and do a Trans 101 training. Well, as I was replaying that story in my mind for that moment, all of a sudden I remembered there was these, at that rest stop, there was these huge, huge cottonwood trees. If you know anything about the Texas Panhandle, the first thing you're going to know is the tallest thing that's out there is probably a scrub oak or a mesquite that's maybe only 8 or 10 feet tall. They ain't no cottonwoods anywhere. Now, here's the other third part of the story. I traveled past that highway 5 more times and never found the rest stop. Now, I don't know how to explain it to you. I don't know how to tell it to you. But I promise you, that rest stop never came back into my view. And so that made my journey of faith awfully real.
Joanne, you often talk about people coming up to you and talking about transition, saying that it must have been a really courageous thing for you to do, but you tend to throw it back to say that courage has nothing to do with it. For you, it was desperation and the desire to survive that got you through this. Did your survival teach you anything about relating to other people that are struggling with issues? Or was there something you learned from your journey to survival?
What I learned was that life is valuable because I tried to commit suicide 4 times. And when I realized that, no, I really wanted to live, and it wasn't courage, as Bree just said, it was a matter of desperation. I had to be me because I had determined in my mind I was not going to die with a man's name on my tombstone. That was out of the question. My dog actually saved me on the 4th pass, because I had a .357 in my mouth and I was prepared to pull the trigger, and she looked up at me to say so much. I hadn't transitioned yet. Looked up to me and said, Mommy, what are you doing? And I put that gun away and sold it the next day. So those kind of events made me realize how valuable our lives are and how valuable our experiences are. But it's not this group that I would talk to. It's the kids that are having trouble being accepted that we need to talk. Those are some of the starfish on the beach that we need to worry about. So what drives me, if that's what you're looking for, is the fact that we've got to reach more than just those of us in this room. We've got to reach out to kids that we know or kids that we come across and say, hey, look, it can get better. If you're not with a birth family that accepts you, God knows there's chosen families that'll love the heck out of you.
I'm curious about that moment at the rest stop, acknowledging it's not you, God, in my way. I'm in my own way. How does that connect to what you were just saying about what we need to do to help kids on this journey?
Well, first of all, I want to say this. It wasn't me coming up with something. There was a spirit that was present in that place that helped me come to that conclusion. And what I would say to kids, please, you're enough. You're perfect the way you are. God loves you just the way you are. You don't need to sit there and think you have to be something else to please him or please anybody else. Be you and be the best you you can be. Dr. Seuss had said it, not Dr. Seuss, but Fred Rogers said it best. Be you and be the best you can be, or something to that effect. And I think that's the best message we can give kids. You know, you're perfect just the way you are.
In many ways, you've been a teacher throughout your entire life. In fact, you were the youngest person ever to hold a position as a technical instructor at Gunter Air Force Base. What is it that drew you to the mentorship and development of others?
I got a big mouth. No, I've always enjoyed public speaking. In fact, in high school, I was on speech and debate and all that kind of stuff. So it came a natural process to do that. But I would tell you that, you know, the leadership opportunities I had in the Air Force of being a lower-level manager and then an upper-level manager, those things helped. And I was active in the JCs for a long time, and they had a program called Leadership in Action. And I was actually one of the trainers for that program in Texas. But here's the kicker. One of the parts of that program was it always asked people to write down your goals. So everybody would ask me, what's your goal? And my answer was always, if I tell you, I'd have to kill you. Because I wasn't going to tell him I want to live my life, the rest of my life as a female, or all I ever wanted to be was a mom and a wife. How am I going to tell somebody that? And here I am wearing six stripes or whatever else. That's an incongruity. That's awful hard to deal with. So it's what I learned while I was in the Air Force, what I learned from JCs, and of course later on managing hotels, all of those things contributed to what I'm able to do now.
Part of what you do now is helping us think about how to take care of one another and providing us that opportunity. As an advocate for the marginalized, how do you develop your expansive view of how we should care for each other?
Well, I think it's 14 or 15 years ago, as president of Trans Central, I got called on to do most of the advocacy work for the organization. And I was gung-ho. Oh, boy, I can speak on behalf of the trans community. And then I started looking at that marginalized circle. And all of a sudden, I found the intersection. And I went, wait a minute, girl. You got to talk about everybody. You got to talk about hearing impaired. You got to talk about people in a wheelchair. You have to talk about people of color. You have to talk about those people who live in food deserts. You have to talk about everybody that's forced to the margins. And that's what drove how my conversation became. Now, kids fall into that intersectionality just as much as adults do. In fact, in some ways, they're affected even more deeply. You know, if a child's in a neighborhood that's not even getting the right amount of food, my goodness, it's even worse on that child than it is just dealing with trans issues. So that.
Joanne, you've remained active and engaged in the community well into your mid-80s as you are today. You did mention earlier that it's really the kids that keep you motivated to keep giving and giving back to the community. But generations change. And how do we impart the lessons of previous generations onto the current generation? Do you use history to help teach some of the lessons that you share?
Most definitely. I talk about a path. And when I was looking for the path, all I found was Christine Jorgensen. The path was about that wide for me. Then there was Renee Richards, and the path was about that wide. And then as time has evolved, the path's gotten wider and wider. So my goal is, how much wider can we make that path? How big can we expand it? Can we make it miles wide so that anybody that identifies as I do, or identifies as non-binary, or is troubled, or even for that matter is running into racial issues because of skin color, how can I make that path wider for somebody? And that should be your objective too. How can you can help that process? And it isn't just about the kids, it's the entire community, because there's more of us than, well, Williams Institute says there's 1.6 million of us trans folks in the world, so in the United States. So we've got enough footprints to go ahead and make that path really wide if we did get really busy. So,
in your work continuing to widen that path, when there are still so many obstacles, demotivators, moments that make it hard, I think perhaps, What is it that you do for yourself to keep you going, to keep your energy and motivation up?
I love what Mara Kiesling said at one of our these previous conferences. We haven't come this far to only come this far. In spite of the Texas, in spite of the Alabamas, in spite of the Idahos, in spite of all those states that are doing their dead level best to put us out of commission, we have not come this far to only come this far. We're going to win overall. It's going to take some time. But it took us a while to get where we are. So we just have to be patient. We have to outlast the bastards in this world. Excuse my language. Okay? And that's really the secret. Hopefully we can have realigning elections in some of those super red states and turn them a little more blue or at least purple. And then we have a shot to make a difference. You have three states right now that are extraditing kids and adults because they decided to leave those states for gender-affirming care. Of whatever description that is, whether it's a counseling or no matter, it's not surgery. If they just want to talk to somebody, that's gender-affirming care, and they don't understand what the rule is. So as long as we have those kind of opportunities, we just have to be patient and do the Chinese water torture to as many people as we can. Drip, 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 drip.
Earlier in the conference, you made a point about learning to tell your own story as being key to advocacy and being able to tell your story in that regard prior to being able to be an advocate for others. How did you go about learning to tell your story and doing it in such a succinct manner? Because so often being able to tell your story quickly and then pivot to other messages is critically important. For you, was it practice? Or did you simply, by virtue of position, get into this place where you had to tell your story to be an advocate?
I think it's because I ultimately got thrust into the position as president of Trans Central and had to take on the advocacy side of that organization's activity. When I stepped away as president and we formed Trans Advocacy Pennsylvania, which is the organization I'm executive director of now, yes, it was over time that you become used to that. You know, I can quote you statistics and stuff all the time, but it's because it's a repetitive process. I was going someplace else in that question, and I can't remember what all the whole thing was. Oh, how do you get there? And I think it's a combination of things. It's those things, the repetitive nature of it, and then just having a natural curiosity about what more can I find out? What more can I add to the plate to make it more delectable for somebody else? And the ultimate desire to keep this going. Because as I told you, my mom was 102 and she passed and she was just quick as a minute. And I don't want to vegetate someplace in a rocking chair. If you're going to go, I want to go out and have St. Peter say, safe, you know? So that's how I'm living it. And so the more active I can stay, the better this feels. I'm also ADHD. I have to have a lot of crap on my plate at one time.
In your work to continue widening that path, when there are still so many obstacles, demotivators, moments that make it hard, what is it that you do for yourself to help keep you going, to keep your energy and motivation up?
You know, I think one of the greatest, well, my grandfather said it best, when you do something for him, your reward is you get to do it again. But for me, it's about seeing the transformative nature of what this conference can be. I knew Bree Wynn. Having seen her evolve makes me feel good. But there's at least 30 to 40 people, much like her, who I've watched go from thinking about it to being it. And to see those people again and seeing them in their vibrant lives, the vibrant parts of their life, absolutely charges my battery. I'm going to tell you a story, but please understand, this is not about hubris, because I really get embarrassed when people thank me. Okay, I really do, because I don't do it to get a reward. I really don't. Trust me. But this girl stopped me when we were setting up for the vendor show, and she said, I really have to thank you. And I went, okay. She said, well, you remember about 4 years ago, I was sitting in a beginner, you know, first-timer's place, and you came over and talked to me. And she's true. That's true. She was sitting there looking like a deer in the headlights. And I thought, oh my God, this girl needs somebody to talk to. So I went and chatted her up for about 30 minutes to an hour. And she said, you know, you made such a difference in my life. Just the fact that you wanted to spend the time talking with me and comforting me and affirming me caused me to take a different life path. She says, I went home, changed my job, and I'm now a counselor in the LGBT community. And I wept. Those are the moments. Sorry. So when I hear that over and over again, or I see that over and over again, man, that's enough to put 14 more volts in a 12-volt battery.
I've had a few of those moments myself, those times where it is the simplest of acts that change someone's life, where just showing a little care makes all the difference in the world. And those moments where you see someone blossom are truly incredible. So we are so thankful for everything you've done to create environments where that is possible. And I think that is a perfect opportunity for us to transition over to some questions from the audience. The first question from the audience was from Jenny. And Jenny asked, when you started your transition, language was different. How have we evolved to all the specific language in use today?
I would say for a lot of us right now, the biggest challenge we have is the gender expansive area. Because growing up, we had a total binary, male, female, black, white. There wasn't all that stuff in the middle. But I like using this spectrograph that I've got in white to black. And I keep telling everybody, you know, we all fit in the middle of someplace. And by the way, you're all just a little bit gay. And that always gets a laugh out of them. But I think that's the thing, that the language issue. When I was growing up, there was no such thing as non-binary. There was no such thing as neurodivergent. All these terms are now coming to the fore. And for somebody who's an old fart like I am, those are hard to kind of readjust my thought process with. Yeah. Just as much as it was recognizing that the trans community was not unique in the pressures it was facing and having to deal with intersectionality. Yeah. Thank you.
Our next question was from Hunter. Hunter has three kids, but only one knows of their gender identity. When Hunter's youngest child was three, he dressed in women's clothes and wore a wig and told Hunter that he was in the wrong body, but never again. And it was very obvious that they couldn't tell the child's father. Now at 11, hasn't talked about it at all. And Hunter asked Joanne, what can I do to ensure he knows that I'm here, I'm open, and I'm affirming?
Here's what I'll give you. You know how to say I love you? Do you know how to add to it just the way you are? Repeat it over and over and over and over. That's the best advice I can give you. Just let him know he's in a space where he's accepted, loved, no matter what. My kids all know that if any of them came out as LGBTQ, I'd throw them out of the house. Only so I could plan the greatest coming out party anybody's ever seen.
Thank you.
You bet. Good luck with it.
Our last audience question was from Lilia. Lilia, who is a frequent listener of Forged in Fire, talked about the crucible moments that people face and how those moments are so often based in trauma. Lilia asked, what turns that into such an energizing force for LGBTQ leaders?
That's a huge question.
I know.
Because I think, and Lilia, I think in all honesty, I have to tell you, it's a combination of events. It's not one thing. The fact that I tried to commit suicide four times because what I couldn't deal with, and this is coming back to you, Hunter, I couldn't face the idea of telling anybody. I didn't want to hurt somebody. And I'm sure your child is in the same way. You don't want to hurt somebody or be hurt for that matter. And that's what kept me in the closet for so long. I didn't want to hurt anybody. I didn't want to hurt my family. And I think that's what affects so many of us. So it was trying to get off myself four times that did it. It was that conversation I told you about on the highway that did it. It was not one thing. It was just a myriad of things that came into that, into my perspective, that I was able to say, aha, an aha moment. And for the rest of you, some of you are living full time, some of you aren't. For those of you that are, or those of you aren't, or are considering the possibility, know this, people you love are going to probably be more accepting and you're willing to give them credit for. Just like my mother, okay? I had presumed forever that she would absolutely have a conniption when I told her that I was a transgender and start telling her my story. I couldn't have been more wrong. Now, my ex-wife, not so much. My kids, they bought into it in a heartbeat. My ex told my two stepdaughters, hey, by the way, she's a transgender woman. We don't care who she is. She made a difference in our life. That's cool. So, in fact, here's the kicker. They both have Facebook pages. My last name starts with a C. Their biological mother's name starts with a B. Guess who appears first on her Facebook page's mother? Me. So there's comeuppance in all things. So it's kind of cool.
Thank you for that great question. And thank you, Joanne, for your answer. Joanne's example is the kind of thing that Bree and I were interested in studying, which is understanding how hurt, pain, and a variety of other challenges that LGBTQ individuals face, adversity, marginalization, stigmatization, are so often beautifully translated into a strength, into energy, into creating positive impact arising out of difficult circumstances. There's something really unique and remarkable about LGBTQ leaders who utilize some of the most terrible experiences throughout their lives, including trauma, and draw something from that which transforms into impact. As leaders having influence on the people in the organizations they lead, and as people having an impact on the world. I was drawn into this work because I study adult development and what happens to individuals that either does or does not develop them into broader, more sophisticated people. What we noticed about these stories is the development that occurs when people transform negative experiences into something incredibly powerful. That's what we were able to write about in our book and what enables us to have these amazing conversations with leaders like Joanne.
There's a book out written by Mildred Brown and the title's escaping me right now. Hopefully, by the time I get to running my mouth, I'll figure it out. Mildred Brown was a psychotherapist, psychologist, gender therapist, whatever. And her book is all about case studies and case stories. And so I gave it to my mother to read. And when she was all done, she said, honey, that book broke my heart. She said, I couldn't believe all of the things I read there and what people had been through. And I said, Mom, you were reading my story with every one of those. And she broke down. And she finally caught on to the angst and the pain that came with it. And so, and that's one of the things I think we can have the opportunity to communicate to people is that this is a painful process, not just because of the physical parts of it or whatever, but it's the emotional side of it. And one last thing, if you transition, take these rabbit ears that you have, fold them up and put them away. If somebody doesn't recognize the fact that you're who you are, be you. It doesn't matter what people think. It's what you think that counts. It's how you matter to yourself that matters. So forget about what somebody says, oh my gosh, there's a man in a dress. And in fact, if you hear that saying, don't you wish you could? Or, you know, something. But use it as an education moment. Don't get mad. But I like to get even once in a while. I didn't say that and you didn't hear me. But you understand what I'm saying? Don't have your rabbit ears up where you can hear, where you're listening for everything. It'll drive you crazy. Be you. Walk the path and say, here I am. Here I am, world. All you haters can go hang it in your ear.
So it's actually really interesting that you bring up the ears. And one of the things we talk about in the development is that scanning work, that understanding the environment that people have to do when they're hiding themselves, yeah, because they're looking for those clues of who's going to know.
Oh, yeah.
If I say this thing or do this thing, will they know something about me? And all the energy that goes into maintaining that sense of awareness. And there's a flip side to that of, look, I get to understand what's going on around me and I build these skills that actually can be used as bridges to other people because I know how to communicate. But when you have built that skill and you can pull down some of the energy that goes into protecting yourself and solely dedicated to communicating and building bridges, that's where a lot of magic really happens.
I don't get outed very much. I don't get made very much,
except when I talk.
But I've learned how to change my voice temper and pitch to the environment that I'm in. Here, I don't give a crap because you guys are all part of my family, okay? But if I'm out in a supermarket, you're probably going to hear me talk like this. So you can fix your voice. There's people here that'll talk to you about that. There's one of the vendors in the vendor room called Vocality. Go visit with them, okay? You can make this. The only place I really get misgendered anymore is on the telephone. So what? My answer is, hey, wait a minute. How many women do you know with the name of Joanne? And usually it stops. So anyway, I had to throw that in.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us today. This was really awesome. We are so glad you joined us. And Joanne, thank you again.
My pleasure.
This is fantastic.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. Forged in Fire is a collective effort brought to you by a fantastic team of passionate individuals. This podcast is produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos, media production by Christina George, operations by Imogene Thomas, and communications by Chelsea Asplund. Brief Ram serves as executive producer and hosts the show along with Dr. Liz Caballero. But we couldn't do this without the inspiration provided by LGBTQ+ leaders around the world working hard to build a better future for all. For more information, visit our website at forgedinfire.org.